You're listening to ESL Podcasts English Cafe, number 306. This is English as a Second Language Podcast, English Cafe, episode 306. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff McQuillan, coming to you from the Center for Educational Development in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Our website is ESLPOD.com. Go there to download a learning guide for this episode and help support us here at ESL Podcast. On this cafe, we're going to have another one of our Ask an American segments, where we listen to other native speakers talking at a normal speed. We're going to listen to them and then explain what they are talking about. Today, we're going to listen to people talking about the health of those who live in the cities, the big cities of the United States. Our first section in this cafe will not be done by me, but by our own Dr. Lucy Say. So we'll be listening to her explain the Ask an American segment, and then I'll come back at the end and answer some questions. Let's get started.
Our topic on this cafe's Ask an American segment is how living in a city can have negative effects on health, or how and why people who live in cities are generally less healthy than people who don't live in cities. We're going to begin by listening to Dr. Joe Buford, who is the president of the New York Academy of Medicine. She speaks very quickly, so it might be hard to understand her. Listen first and try to understand as much as you can. Then I'll go back and explain what she said before we listen to her once again. Let's listen.
All of those things are playing out in the urban environment in a way that they don't play out outside of cities. And they have an effect on people's health, on people's well-being, and on, you know, daily life. But the real thing that runs through higher incidence of disease is largely poverty. I mean, that's the bottom line.
She begins by saying that all those things, referring to things that are present in cities, are playing out in the urban environment. To play out means to occur or happen and have different consequences, especially when we don't know exactly what will happen or what the final results will be. For example, if you're reading an interesting mystery novel, and you know I love mystery novels, it may be hard to put it down and stop reading because you want to see how everything will play out. Dr. Buford is talking about how things play out in the urban, U-R-B-A-N, environment. Something that is urban is related to cities, not the countryside. The opposite of urban is rural, R-U-R-A-L. When we think of urban environments, we might think of subways, tall buildings, and great restaurants. Dr. Buford says that things play out in the urban environment in ways that they don't play out outside of cities or in rural areas. She says that the way these factors play out in urban environments have an effect on people's health, well-being, and daily life. Well-being refers to how happy, healthy, and comfortable a person is. Health usually refers to someone's physical health, how their body feels. But well-being is bigger because it refers to not only physical health, but mental health, emotional health, and spiritual health. People who talk about well-being are recognizing the fact that physical health isn't enough. For example, if people are physically healthy but have serious mental or emotional problems, they may not be healthy, happy, and comfortable. Then, Dr. Buford talks about how poverty affects disease. Poverty, P-O-V-E-R-T-Y, refers to the condition of being very poor and not having enough money to pay for food, clothing, and shelter, S-H-E-L-T-E-R, or a place to live. She says that poverty is associated with a higher incidence of disease. Incidence, I-N-C-I-D-E-N-C-E, refers to how common something is or how often it happens. If there is a low incidence of yellow fever, very few people are sick with yellow fever. If there is a high incidence of yellow fever, a lot of people are sick. Dr. Buford says that where there is poverty, there is a higher incidence of disease. Where people are very poor, more people tend to be sick more often. She ends by saying, that's the bottom line. The bottom line refers to what is most important. In business, the bottom line refers to how much money a company has made after paying all of its expenses and taxes. In other contexts or in other situations, the bottom line is what's most important. In this case, the bottom line is the fact that poverty is associated with a greater incidence of disease. Let's listen to Dr. Buford say all of that again.
All of those things are playing out in the urban environment in a way that they don't play out outside of cities. And they have an effect on people's health, on people's well-being, and on, you know, daily life. But the real thing that runs through higher incidence of disease is largely poverty. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Now let's listen to Dr. Buford talk about how businesses are reacting to the ways in which living in a city affects their employees' health. She's going to talk about the things many companies are doing to improve the health of their employees who live in urban areas.
They provide health education opportunities for their own employees. Many of them provide programs in-house for people to stop smoking. They provide programs for people that feel they may be depressed or they may have substance abuse problem to get help, weight loss programs, exercise programs, giving people a break at lunch hour to go out in the community and walk and get exercise. So the return on investment is pretty clear at this point in time.
Dr. Buford says that companies provide health education opportunities for their employees. She says many of the employers have in-house programs to help people stop smoking. An in-house program is something that is offered in the business, in the company, where the people go to work. Lots of programs are available in the community, at medical clinics, or through nonprofit organizations. But an in-house program is something created and operated by the employer for his or her own employees. Dr. Buford says that some companies provide programs for people who feel depressed. Someone who is depressed, D-E-P-R-E-S-S-E-D, or who suffers from depression, feels very sad, usually for no reason. Those feelings last for a long time and may make it hard for that person to get out of bed, to go to work, or to lead a normal life. So some programs help people who feel depressed. other programs help people who have substance abuse problems. Substance, S-U-B-S-T-A-N-C-E. Abuse, A-B-U-S-E, refers to people's addictions to alcohol and other drugs, where they need to have more and more alcohol or drugs in order to feel good and to make it through the day. They aren't able to stop drinking alcohol or using drugs on their own. So the employers here have programs to help their employees overcome. O-V-E-R-C-O-M-E, their substance abuse problem, and become healthy again. She also mentions programs to help people lose weight and exercise. And she talks about how some companies let their employees take a break at lunchtime or stop working for a while so they can leave the building and walk outdoors to get some exercise. She says that the return on investment is pretty clear at this point in time, or now. The return on investment, or ROI, is another phrase from the business world, like bottom line. The return on investment is a calculation that helps us understand how much money we have made in relation to how much money we have spent. For example, if you spend $10,000 on a marketing campaign and sales increase by $40,000, then you have had a 400% return on investment. Dr. Buford isn't referring to specific numbers here, but she means that companies are realizing that their investments in programs that improve their employees' health actually end up saving the company money, probably because the employees take fewer sick days or days off from work because they're sick, and because they're more productive or able to do more work more quickly when they're healthy. Let's listen to Dr. Buford as she talks about this one more time.
They provide health education opportunities for their own employees. Many of them provide programs in-house for people to stop smoking. They provide programs for people that feel they may be depressed or they may have substance abuse problem to get help, weight loss programs, exercise programs, giving people a break at lunch hour to go out in the community and walk and get exercise. So the return on investment is pretty clear at this point in time.
Now let's listen to Javier Lopez, who is the director of New York's Strategic Alliance for Health. He's talking about what schools can do to improve the health of students in an urban setting, S-E-T-T-I-N-G, or environment.
So then you have to look at opportunities outside of the school day for physical activity. You have more bike lanes, for instance, in some urban settings now. So you have to think about what programs that are going to bring young people to use those bike lanes. You have to think about what bike sharing programs are available in urban settings and thinking outside of the box to using the landscape to be more effective for physical activity.
Javier says that what we have to look at are opportunities for physical activity and movement outside of the school day or when children are not at school. As an example, he says that some urban environments now have more bike lanes. A lane, L-A-N-E, is one section of a road for cars going in a particular direction. Most roads are two-lane roads, with one lane of cars going one way and another lane of cars going the other way. A bike lane is a narrower section of road that is specifically for bicycles so that they don't have to share the lane with cars. Javier says that having bike lanes isn't enough. He says people need to think about what kinds of programs are going to encourage young people to use those bike lanes. He says you have to think about what bike sharing programs are available in urban settings. A bike sharing program allows people to use a bicycle for a short period of time, maybe for a small fee. That is, pay just a little bit of money to use it, and then leave it somewhere for someone else to use. Javier talks about the need to think outside of the box. That means to think in new and unusual ways, and to have ideas that other people may have not had before. He says we need to think outside the box about how we can use the landscape to encourage more physical activity. The word landscape, L-A-N-D-S-C-A-P-E, refers to what we can see around us, and it is often used to talk about large natural areas like a mountain landscape. But there are city landscapes too, and Javier is talking about looking for ways people can engage in more physical activity. They can do more physical activity in those urban landscapes. Let's listen to Javier again as he talks about this.
So then you have to look at opportunities outside of the school day for physical activity. You have more bike lanes, for instance, in some urban settings now. So you have to think about what programs that are going to bring young people to use those bike lanes. You have to think about what bike sharing programs are available in urban settings, and thinking outside of the box to using the landscape to be more effective for physical activity.
The speakers we've listened to today work in New York, but their concerns about health and city living are very similar to the concerns we have here in Los Angeles and in other large cities throughout the United States and in much of the rest of the world. I've enjoyed sitting in for Jeff today. Thank you, Jeff, for letting me come and visit here on the English Cafe. But now I'm going to turn it back over to you to answer a few of our listener questions.
Our first question comes from Irene, from an unknown country. We'll call it the country of the unknown. Irene wants to understand the meaning of two phrases, two ways of asking a question, really. The first is, how do you say? And the second is, what do you call? Both of these are useful questions when you are learning a language and you want to ask someone else, perhaps a teacher or another speaker, to help you. Let's start with how do you say. How do you say is another way of saying what is the word to use for saying a certain thing. For example, let us imagine that you are learning French. You might ask your teacher, how do you say friends? Or how do you say friends in French? Your teacher might say, mon ami. That's how you say friends in French. How do you say that question can also be used to ask how you pronounce a word. You might be reading something and you don't know how to pronounce a word. So you say to your friend, pointing with your finger at the word, how do you say that? Or how do you say A-M-I-E in French? Is it ami? That's another way of using that question. What do you call is also used when you don't know the word in the other language for a certain thing or concept. You could use it in the same circumstances as the previous question. You could say, what do you call a friend in French. Now, normally when we use this question, what do you call, you only use it when asking about a singular, that is, one of a certain thing. Notice when I said, how do you say, I said, how do you say my friend? There was no a or an in front of the word I was, or phrase I was looking for. When you use how do you call, you're asking about something singular. And so you're going to use the singular article, either definite or indefinite, in front of the thing that you don't know how to say. Let me give you an example. What do you call a table in Spanish? The answer is mesa, or una mesa. Now, I can also say, how do you say table in Spanish? Notice, however, that I didn't say a table. So the general rule is this. If what you are asking about is singular, you can use the questions, how do you say, or what do you call a something. If it's plural, you can only use how do you say. You can't use what do you call. For example, you can't say, what do you call my friends in French? That's incorrect, or it means something different than what you're trying to ask. You would have to say, how do you say my friends in French? What do you call can also be used when you're asking about the name of someone or something. For example, what do you call your dog? You're asking, what is your dog's name? Liang, L-I-A-N-G, from another unknown country, probably the same country Irene is from. Maybe they know each other. In any case, Liang wants to know the parts of a standard resume in English. A resume, R-E-S-U-M-E, is a piece of paper or papers, or nowadays file, that you give to the person or the company that you want to work for. So when you are applying for a job, when you are looking for work, for many kinds of jobs, you have a resume that you can give them, and the resume includes all of the important information about you and why they should hire you in a way for this job. The most important parts of the resume, the ones that are absolutely necessary, essential, are sections about your work experience, especially your work experience related to the job for which you are applying. So if you want to become a computer engineer, your work experience should include things that you have done related to computers. If you want to work on a farm, your resume should include things related to farms, not computers, unless you use a computer on a farm. You understand what I'm saying. Another important necessary section is one with your education. If you're an adult, the person will want to know if you finished high school, if you went to college, or if you have some other training for the job that you are applying for. The experience and education sections are the most important, usually, on a resume. There are other things that you might want to put in there. Some people give a short summary, one sentence or two sentences of their work experience. Some people put down an objective. This is the kind of job that you want to get. So even if the job isn't exactly that, if it's related, or if that's one of the possibilities for future advancement, future employment at that company, For example, you start as a computer engineer, but your real goal is to be a, I don't know, website developer. Well, that could be your objective, your long-term, we might say, objective for the future. You can also put down any special skills you have. For example, are you fluent in English? Do you speak Japanese? These are skills that you might have. Or if you are applying for a secretary job, you might want to indicate how fast you can type, how fast you can keyboard, I guess we say now. If you are applying for an academic job, a job at a school, especially a university, you would put down perhaps presentations or publications that you have. Some resumes include a list of your hobbies or activities. This isn't essential. This is not necessary. Those are often put on resumes when the resume is short. For a young person who doesn't have a lot of experience, they want to put something down, so they put that down. Finally, some people, when they hand in their resumes, also give a list of references. These are people that the employer, the person who's hiring, can call to talk about your experience. These could be people you worked for. These could be professors that you had in school. The reference will, in part, depend upon the job that you are applying for. Liang had a specific question about languages, where that would go on the resume, what section. I would say that could go under special skills or simply skills that we talked about earlier. Finally, Mario, M-A-R-I-O, from Italy, wants to know where we put the word to, T-O-O, in a sentence. He saw it in the middle of a sentence. He also has seen it at the end of a sentence. Where you put it depends on the meaning. One meaning of to is also. Your husband or wife says to you, I love you. And you say, I love you too. To, when it means also, usually goes at the end of a sentence or a clause within a sentence. You can put it, however, between the subject and the verb. For example, you can say, I too love you, instead of, I love you too. That is not quite as common. It was more common perhaps many years ago. Sometimes people will use that for emphasis. I too love you. You're emphasizing the I part. But as I said, typically if it means also, it goes at the end of the sentence or clause. The word too, T-O-O, can also mean too much or an excess of something. You might say, oh, it's too cold outside to take a walk. It's too hot in the sun. I'm going to go and swim in the pool. Well, there, too, goes before whatever adjective you're talking about. It's too hot. It's too cold. Hot and cold are adjectives. To goes before them. Usually to implies something negative. However, that's not always true. Someone could say, oh, you're too kind. They don't mean that as a negative thing. They're complimenting you. They're saying that you are kinder than perhaps you need to be. If you have a question, you can email us. Our email address is esl.pod@esl.pod.com. From Los Angeles, California, I'm Jeff McQuillan. Thank you for listening. Come back and listen to us again here on The English Cafe. ESL Podcast English Cafe is written and produced by Dr. Jeff McQuillan and Dr. Lucy Fay. Copyright 2011 by the Center for Educational Development.